rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once, or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to Red Box, the politics podcast in The Times. I'm Matt Chorley, back for another episode of political debate, insight and gossip, despite a million people signing a petition calling for me to be banned. We've kept out any bad dudes, but an impressive lineup of guests have fought their way through our tough vetting procedures to seek refuge in the Red Box studio. Joining me this week are legendary documentary maker Michael Cockrell, who lifts the lid on decades spent trying to get a politician to answer a question, Times senior political correspondent and podcast regular Lucy Fisher will cast an eye over the imminent political battles you might not have noticed. And we welcome to the Red Box family Ian Martin, who's just joined The Times as a columnist. And he's going to be talking about a man you might have seen in the news called Donald Trump. Welcome to you all. Before we begin, a reminder to subscribe to the podcast on your Android device or on iTunes, where if you post a review, we promise to have you exempted from the ban on listening to next week's show. And if you don't receive my morning email briefing, I'm not sure we can be friends. So sign up now at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. Right, let's get started with Michael, a man who's made dozens of documentaries on the great offices of state, the whips, the civil service, the commons, and in the 1990s, a documentary called How to Be a Prime Minister. But today we ponder how to be a journalist interviewing a Prime Minister.
I wanted to talk about the love-hate relationship that British Prime Ministers have had over the years with television. I've been lucky enough to film our last nine Prime Ministers, and I recognise that Theresa May's uncomfortable refusal to give a straight answer to a question on what she thought about President Trump's refugee policy is only the latest in a long line of prime ministerial embarrassments on camera. And thanks for the earlier introduction. Thanks for the obituary. I've been in the coffin and hearing the obloquy or whatever it is. Yeah, I'm lucky enough to have interviewed the last nine prime ministers, and I've watched as their relationship with television has changed over the years. I remember I once said to Margaret Thatcher, what do you think of these big set-piece TV interviews? And she said, I hate them. I hate them. I hate them. And interestingly, over the years, as television interviewers have got tougher in the way they do it, and prime ministers themselves have had their own spin doctors and have tried to work out what kind of questions are going to be asked. I remember that Bernard Ingham used to play the role of the dreaded Sir Robin Day, and he was apparently much tougher than Robin Day. And equally, Alistair Campbell used to play the role in rehearsals with Tony Blair of Jeremy Paxman, and was much tougher on Tony Blair than even Paxo was. So it's interesting. It's action and reaction. I remember once when I was on Panorama and Robin Day was going off to do an interview with Margaret Thatcher, he said, why don't I ask, Prime Minister, what's your answer to my first question? And because she would have been rehearsing it with Bernard Ingham, and he knew that whatever he said, she would come up with her pre-prepared sound bites. I mean, Mrs. May has a new way of doing it, which is the meaningless tautology. I mean, I suppose tautology is Brexit is Brexit, means nothing. Or what do you think of President Trump's ban on immigrants from a number of Muslim countries? the Americans have their way of running their immigration policy. We have our way of running an immigration policy. What do you think of it? And then she repeats it,
yeah.
This, which is an interesting way of doing it. But at least, I suppose it's a sort of answer. I mean, some of the answers that she's given in some of her set piece interviews to Andrew Marr or Robert Peston haven't been answers at all. They answered a completely different question from the one she's asked.
I remember towards the end of last year, and unfortunately I can't remember who the name of the academic, but somebody who'd repeatedly done academic studies of politicians and the way they avoid answering questions, and he'd had to create a whole new category for Theresa May. Because it wasn't that she was avoiding the question as such, but she would sort of talk around the subject. So at the first glance, it sounded like she'd answered it. But actually, it was a sort of separate issue that she was sort of addressing. So, the Donald Trump one is a sort of separate point, but asked, what do you think about the new American immigration policy? She says the US immigration policy is a matter for the US, which sort of sounds like she's out there, which is not really, it's just a sort of diversion tactic. How do you think she sort of ranks compared to the other prime ministers that you've answered? Is she more tricky?
Yes, that's a very good question. I mean, she's sort of in a post-Paxman era. There aren't that many people, although some of the guys and women coming up, like Sophie Ridge asking that very good question about what to Theresa May about what she thought about Donald Trump's approach to women and that he liked to grab them by the pussy, or as Sophie Ridge herself said, like to grab them by the pussy. she couldn't actually say it, but Theresa May's face as she was asked that question was wonderful, basilisk of stone, that face set in stone. I mean, I go back right the way, not in terms of having interviewed him, but in terms of Anthony Eden in 1951, during the 1951 election, was asked by the BBC's then top interviewer, a guy called Leslie Mitchell, "Sir Anthony, you're a world expert on world affairs, yet you're equally at home. So where am I to start the interview?" "Could you start abroad?" "Yes, sir." Compare that to, say, Robin Day, about 25 years later, talking to Ted Heath, where he said, that wasn't even 25 years, it was 15 years later, he said, "Mr. Heath, how low does your popularity have to sink among your own supporters before you consider yourself a liability to the party you lead?" Good question for Jeremy Corbyn. And, and Heath said, "Well, popularity isn't everything." And he managed to win the next general election by being significantly less popular than the Tories were in the polls. So maybe he was right.
Michael, I just wanted to ask you, do you think that you can get something of the essential essence of a person through television? Or is it just that some people have a better talent for appearing authentic, but actually they've just had great training and the sort of personality where they can put it on?
Once you can fake sincerity, you've got it made.
Yeah.
I mean, you can learn certain techniques on television. You can learn to get used to the cameras, to relax in front of the cameras. But I think that television is a very good portrayer of character, especially over the months and the years. You actually do get a strong sense of their character, whether they're straight or not, whether they're decisive, a whole range of things. And if you're lucky enough, as I have been over the years, to make a number of documentaries about many of our leading political figures, and you film with them over a period of weeks and in different circumstances, you take them back to where they were at school or university or where they were born, and you get different stimuli which releases different things about them. And also, one of the things I've often done is to show them clips of their past life, so and that really opens them up. I remember when I was doing a film with Ken Clark, he said, "So how are you going to do this?" I said, "Well, there'll be film of you, which we've got going back quite a long way, some of which you may never have seen before. So just want you to react naturally." He said, "You mean you want me to sit here and shout at the television like I do at home?" I said, "You've got it in one." But it does, because they start thinking of themselves. Jim Callaghan, when we had some film of him as a very junior transport minister who introduced pedestrian crossings, and He was about sort of 26 or 27, and he said, "What an interesting young man. Whatever happened to him?" But they're all thinking about, you know, en recherche de temps perdu, and it opens them up.
Do you think the problem with Theresa May, though, Michael, might be that she actually really, on quite a basic level, lacks confidence? She's quite a shy, quite reserved person, not very good at spontaneous remarks. And it just, that hesitancy really showed, in particularly in the interview in Turkey, or the press conference in Turkey, where...
And even the one in Dublin last night, and she really was very unsure of what she was going to say, and she her mouth turned down as well, because television's very much a medium of impressions, and you do see, you do get a strong sense of what they're like, especially under pressure. But I think you're right. I think people who know her well say that she's not very self-confident, and she's certainly rather cautious, and she's suddenly been thrown in. I mean, if you think of her last few days, going to see Trump and address the Republican convention, effectively conference, and then off to Turkey, and then in Dublin, having been in Cardiff with the leaders of the devolved assemblies, it's amazing that she's been thrown into this. It's the normal life of a prime minister, but I think the way they run a prime minister's life, there's almost a kind of machismo thing that you have to be able to fly overnight and then have a meeting with someone like Erdogan. It's terrible, but it preparation might, for it.
In some way, though, Michael, it might actually explain part of her appeal to voters, don't you think, in that she's not slick and perfect and a little too clever by half in the way that, for example, Blair was. Even David Cameron, but Blair was particularly good at that response. And voters have got very used to that in the last 20 years and maybe don't particularly like it. So there is something authentic about her, but it does seem to keep, as you indicated, it keeps landing her in trouble.
Yes, I mean, I would hate it if you thought that I thought she should be slicked up. I'd like to see her, you know, with some of the human sides. And she looked, the point was, when she came to power, she looked like a grown-up after all the shenanigans and the public school tricks that were going on in the Tory leadership and everything like that. I think I've talked to some of her people that one of the things they said is, of course, we never really expected it to happen straight away.
Yeah.
You know, we were planning.
They thought at the very least they'd have the summer to prepare.
Exactly.
Or whatever. I was struck actually that the lobby briefing in Parliament yesterday, where journalists go every day and they can at least ask questions of Number 10, whether or not they get an answer is another point. And there were lots of questions about why the Prime Minister had been so slow to respond to the Trump policy, and the response was, you lot sit on your screen and go, oh, look at this on Twitter now, she's got to be properly briefed. And I can see where they're coming from, that they don't want to lurch into the sort of David Cameron knee-jerk reaction to absolutely everything, congratulating Mobo winners and all that sort of stuff. But on the other hand, they can't, she's very controlling, she wants to read the evidence before she comes to a view, but you can't do that with unexpected events, and there's a balance that I think she's probably got to strike.
Yes, I think that's right. And because I think the public like least that either the not answering the question or coming up with the same soundbite, which had obviously been prepared, and they then use the same soundbite for their next three answers.
Like Brexit means Brexit.
Yeah. But I think that Theresa May has such an easy time of it because Jeremy Corbyn doesn't do a great job of holding her to account, and while, you know, she hesitates at the dispatch box, you know, there's that slackness in the chamber now. She's not kind of having to bounce off someone high impact, high energy. David Cameron had to be slicker because he was up against Ed Miliband, who did quite a good job and had Ed Balls next to him and great repartee and witticisms, and there's none of that now.
Yeah, I think that's right. And she did manage brilliantly to destabilise him of last week's PMQs when she came up with the white paper, that she was going to have the white paper, and that was his whole
when are you going to have it?
So he then says, well, what day is it going to be?
So let's move on now to someone who's not afraid to indulge in a little bit of straight talking. Ian, you want to talk about events across the Atlantic.
Yeah, I want to pose the question, is Trump winning? Because you've got here in the UK and in the US, you've got protesters filling the streets, well, you know, some of the streets. But I just think it might be worth entertaining the possibility that the people who voted for Donald Trump in the American election last year actually rather like what he's doing.
So we've had these extraordinary protests. I mean, actually, you know, the number of people who turned out in Whitehall last night with 24 hours notice in reaction to a policy which won't have affected all, very many of them. You know, it's a long way away. And, you know, we're not one of the countries which were affected, we're told. And yet there is this sort of very angry reaction almost to everything that Donald Trump says and does. His supporters point out that actually what he's doing is just an extension of what Barack Obama had put in place, you know, yes. Some of the controls on some of the countries affected. But your point is that actually he's not trying to win over placard-wielding Brits. He's delivering on what was his...
He deliberately promise. Doesn't care. I mean, I'm no fan of Donald Trump. Spent a lot of time there during the US election. Every time I went over there, I was convinced by smart Republicans that, of course, he would be knocked out and Rubio would stop him. And then it was going to be Cruz, and then it was going to be someone else, and Fiorina, and then it wasn't, and suddenly it was him. And then, of course, he couldn't win the general election, and he did. So I'm very worried by quite a lot of what he's doing. But I think, and if you talk to, as I did recently to, the last 24 hours, to someone who's close to the administration, I don't think they're applying the normal rules. I think his measurement is quite simple. It is, in those states where he won, what are his numbers like? He knows that he's never, ever going to win California. Or he knows he's never going to win in Manhattan or in London. And actively doesn't care. And it sends a signal to his base that, as far as they're concerned, he's annoying the right people. This is, I think, and remember, this is only 10 days into this, guys.
It's amazing.
10, 11 days. It feels like 10 years. But... I think that then raises the question about those who want to block him or hold him to account or theoretically defeat him at some point, either at the midterms in less than 2 years or in 4 years' time at the general election, need to, in a sense, calm down and think, how do you respond to this?
Yeah.
It is quite likely that what emerges on the back of the protest movement is something bigger than just a usual protest movement, that it is a dump Trump movement which can attract middle ground mainstream support. There seems to be some suggestion of that happening in the US. That's certainly the case in London and places like Glasgow last night, where there were big demonstrations. It needs to just be more than left-wing radicals demonstrating. And practical reality in the US is that nothing Britain does will make any difference to this, is that it has to produce a person, a candidate.
Yeah, and actually it was the total absence of a candidate, of a decent candidate, yeah, in the Republicans or the Democrats that actually cleared the way for you.
Well, a Democrat friend of mine said to me, they've got to think completely out of the box. They can't just have one of these anonymous people who've made no impact at any point in the last couple of years. Obama hasn't left a next generation. The Democrats are in serious trouble. If you look at... the number of governors that the Republicans now have both houses, have the presidency, obviously. They're going to almost have to out-Trump Trump. I mean, someone suggested the name Oprah Winfrey to
yeah.
me. But, you know, we laugh, but then we laughed at Trump 6 months ago, a year ago.
Anymore.
We don't laugh
yeah,
at anything.
Yeah.
I draw the line at maybe Kim Kardashian, but it's that the movement is only going to be effective if it turns into something which can translate itself into a practical political campaign.
Michelle Obama would be the person to go for it. She's so popular and she looks so wonderful on all those shows that she appears on.
To what extent do you think she might fall foul of the... I mean, she doesn't have the same negative baggage as Hillary Clinton, but it would have the same problem of it being,
yes,
you know, the dynasty, the, you know, my turn, you know, Washington bubble...
Yep.
Issue that Hillary just could never shake off.
And she has very specifically said that she wouldn't do it.
But we've all heard that
people
before.
People always can talk their way out of that. It's just you need someone with charisma and attractiveness and someone, as Ian is saying, a bit different from these extraordinary dull people on both sides.
I mean, it was particularly striking during the Republican primaries just how... There was Trump and then sort of eight or nine,
yes,
identical. They had the same haircut. They had the same suits. They, you know, they came out with all the same stuff.
But they were differentiated because Trump had a different perfect set of insults for each one of them.
little marker,
exactly.
But it also has to be someone who can appeal very specifically in those states that won it for Trump, which is that the incredible to think in places like Michigan that Donald Trump beat the Democrats. So it's got to be someone that can actually plug back into disaffected white working class or middle class, in American terms, voters, and reconnect with some message on the nation state, the economy, jobs. I mean, ultimately, I think what it's really going to come down to, and what the voters who are going to decide this in the US are going to make their minds up based on the economy. And if the economy really booms, which it might do, what could possibly go wrong at the end of that, then he's even more difficult to defeat. But extraordinary things are happening in the US, where you now see Apple are moving all their call center jobs back. There's a huge push by CEOs to announce US jobs. So he's doing stuff that underneath the outrage and the international bafflement, he's doing stuff that is going to connect in Michigan and in Texas and in North and South Carolina.
Lucy, there is a sense, Ian's touched on it there, that if you sort of took the very sharp edges off some of the stuff he's doing, and actually the way he announces things and he goes on Twitter and explodes every time somebody criticises him, actually, if you took all of that, there could potentially be quite a politically successful occupant of the White House there. If he is delivering on the jobs, he's delivering on the immigration policy he promised.
Yes.
That makes him a success.
Yes. And in fact, I mean, I think the interesting thing you're talking about, even with these edges that, as you describe it, Matt, I mean, perhaps that is part of the success. You know, that sets him up in contrast to the liberal metropolitan elite who, in the wake of the global financial crash, you know, people think are still running the show, rigging international free trade for their own ends against the little people. I mean, that is part of the success. And it's interesting, as we see kind of from the Women's March on the day after the inauguration to yesterday's scenes across the UK and around the rest of the world of people protesting, I just wonder if that as well is part of the strategy, the sort of the clever Steve Bannon sort of provoking that outrage. Actually, that distances that sort of progressive liberal cause from the majority of people who care about earning a decent wage, having maybe a car, a TV, a holiday. They're not people who would ordinarily take to the streets. They don't fit in and they don't like that sort of identity of protesters. So whipping up this outrage among sort of what as you describe, Ian, the radical left, and even possibly more centre-ground people, I think that probably only distances and alienates the majority of middle America from the Democrats and from that sort of liberal cause.
Michael, just going back to what we were talking about at the beginning and answering a straight question, it really struck me during the press conference with Theresa May, where there were only four questions, I think, and Laura Coonsberg from the BBC got a bit of criticism for daring to pose a difficult question to him. And one of them was making the point about what he'd said about torture and should people back in the UK, but also in America, be worried about his view on that. And instead of avoiding it and doing a Theresa May, he took it head on and said, I still think that torture works, but I've appointed a general. He says it doesn't. He's in charge. So I bow to his authority. And actually, I was really struck just in that press conference what a really quite clever communicator he is, which isn't the sort of the caricature of him that we sometimes get.
Yeah, I think the caricature of him is not that. I mean, it's the most other leading politicians. What do people object to? The fact he never answers the question, or she never answers the question, or she comes up with the pre-prepared sound bites. He doesn't do that. He most of the time he sounds as if he's saying what he believes. Although when you go through it, often he's contradicted himself in the previous or will in the next press conference. Like as you say, the defense secretary. I've appointed the defense secretary. He has a different view. I defer to him. That obviously didn't carry through till yesterday when he's acting deputy attorney general. Oh, you don't agree with me, you're out.
Yeah.
And there are hundreds and hundreds of examples of this over the years with him. But he does, as far as a journalist is concerned, he's perfect because he gives you an answer to the question.
He's definitely good for trade. I'm almost certain we will turn to
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast, now available on the Times radio app.
Donald Trump in the coming weeks. But Lucy, let's focus on politics slightly closer to home.
The political gods have smiled and granted us in February not one but two by-elections, the finest and most idiosyncratic of all Westminster's travelling circus acts. As well as paving the way for endless vox pops, sketches, colour pieces and photo ops, these two battles might actually tell us something about Labour's electoral prospects.
So Lucy, Jamie Reid stood down in Copeland, Tristram Hunt stood down in Stoke-on-Trent Central to go and work at the V&A. And these are interesting because Tories potentially in a good shout in Copeland, but Stoke-on-Trent Central is potentially more interesting because UKIP have got a serious challenge there and Paul Nuttall, the new UKIP leader, is standing there as the candidate.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I love a by-election. I think it's sort of the political class of Westminster split into two types, those that find them tedious and the idea of getting on a train to get outside London is nightmarish, and the likes of me and Michael Crick, who sort of live for the local thrills. So, yeah, I think Stoke-on-Trent seems to me the slightly more interesting of the two, although they both test Labour in different ways. Stoke-on-Trent is the most Eurosceptic city in the UK, 70% voted out. And what I also think is really interesting about this seat is that it's incredible levels of apathy in the general election. Fewer than 50% of the electorate bothered to turn out to vote in 2015, but 66% turned out for the EU referendum. So they were galvanised by the issue of the EU. And UKIP is standing Paul Nuttall, their leader, that underlines their confidence there. Jeremy Corbyn's sort of tortuous policies on Brexit and immigration, whether he's sort of totally for freedom of movement or he sort of could envisage some sort of controls, whether Article 50 should be, you know, it could be a free vote. No, actually, it's going to be a three-line whip. Unclear about whether people will have to resign, although two Labour frontbenchers already have, and now the suggestion is that others will have to if they want to vote against it. I think that's all going to play out on the ground, and it's a test for UKIP. If they can't win here in such a Eurosceptic place, they're in trouble, aren't they?
Yeah, it's interesting how their test for all of the parties in a way is to see whether or not they can deliver, because politicians always say, I'm only interested in one poll, and that's the one on election day, which is why, actually, I'm with you on by-elections. They have at least a test of the public mood at that time. And we saw what happened in Richmond, that Zach Goldsmith quit as the Conservative MP there, and he wants to basically have a referendum on Heathrow, and the Lib Dems successfully turned it into a referendum on Brexit and won the seat. Michael, where do you stand on the by-election debate?
I love by-elections. I used to go and make behind-the-scenes by-elections films, which could only go out on the night just after the polls closed, but you could get amazing stuff and you would keep it in the camera until it went out. And I remember Dick Taverne, the famous by-election as it then was in 1973, when he was a prototype of the Social Democratic Party, because he resigned over Europe because his constituency in Lincoln, like now, was Eurosceptic, and he was very pro-European. It was on the question of whether you were going to vote for us to go into the then common market. But he had got in 10 years earlier at a by-election, and he said, I love by-elections. You learn more about politics and how good you are at connecting with people, making speeches on the stump, making speeches at set meetings, doing interviews in those kind of 3 weeks of a by-election than you ever do in a general election, because the spotlight is not on you in the same way if it's a high-profile by-election.
And because during a general election, the air campaign of the party leaders,
absolutely,
that sort of takes over and
yes,
will decide the outcome,
yes,
far more.
Ian? I do love by-elections, but a particularly niche kind of by-election in that I love Scottish by-elections, which I was raised on. So in the 90s...
Very specialist.
The Scots absolutely, you know, were brilliant at by-elections. Things like Perth and Kinross, where the Nationalists made a great sort of advance, or Monklands East, when just after John Smith had died, which was actually pretty horrible, really, with Helen Liddell and the SNP and a sectarian crazy backdrop. And it just was a circus. But I generally think I agree with Lucy. I think they really test people. I think they're good for the media. Too often we're stuck in London and need to get out more and just encounter the sheer silliness and and madness of the election trail. And you'd also then see the joy of national politicians who would really rather be spending their time in television studios or hobnobbing with the liberal elite, having to actually speak in events in rather less glamorous situations and face the public and be trailed around by Lucy and Michael Crick. And I think it's terrifically important.
And there's no greater corrective for, well, not just politicians, but political journalists as well, who are convinced that the entire nation hangs on their every word and thought, to turn up in a sort of drizzly high street somewhere and spend an hour asking people what you think about the by-election. Is it the what? And discovering that actually their hard work up until that point has gone largely unnoticed by people who are going about their daily lives. And I think that that's probably always good for people. Ian, UKIP, where do you sort of see them post-Brexit? Are they capable of creating the sort of momentum that the SNP did, having they actually lost the referendum but then sort of swept the board? Or have they lost their sort of raison d'etre?
The by-elections will tell us a lot about that, because I was one of those people that thought on the back of the Brexit result, Labour is dead in Scotland, in real trouble in the north, and that it would then have UKIP on its tail, and that UKIP would turn its sort of 12, 13, 14% of the vote into a solid vote and maybe win the odd seat in events like this. I think that the difficulty that Paul Nuttall has is it's just difficult to get beyond Farage. I mean, the guy is doing an Alex Salmond in that he's retired, but he's not really retired. He's all over TV and radio. He's playing a part in an inherently ridiculous way in the Trump story. And I think if you were to ask most voters who's the leader of UKIP, they'd probably still say Nigel Farage, because he's resigned and then stood again so many times. So there's
they
a,
would
there's
say
a,
Diane James
precisely. I don't think anyone. I'd forgotten about Diane James,
but
haven't we all?
I think they have a real identity problem there, which is added to by the fact that you've then got Farage's friends, people like Aaron Banks. So it's not clear precisely what they're going to do with their money and their support. Are they going to start some new populist party, which they've made reference to, or are they going to put money behind UKIP? So it's a little more fragile for them than it looked as though they were set for significant success after Brexit, but maybe their work is done.
I must admit, I was struck even watching the TV news last night, and there was a piece on Article 50 in the debate in Parliament, and it included a clip with Nigel Farage. And yeah, I just thought, why is a local radio disc jockey being interviewed on that basis rather than Paul Nuttall? Or
of course, the interesting thing is if Paul Nuttall wins, he will win at his first parliamentary try. You know, as poor old Nigel Farage tried about eight times.
Eight times, still without success.
Still without success. So there'll be a wonderful irony there. Also, it's made much easier for him, for Nuttall, because the Labour Party, in their infinite wisdom, probably on instructions from the brain god Corbyn, have chosen an ardent Remainer as their candidate in the most
genius
Eurosceptic seat in the country.
Yeah, and the argument was that he was the most appropriate person they'd got on the shortlist, which for me suggests they probably needed a new shortlist.
Is
rather
there
than
an argument that sort of suggests people were thinking about it?
Well, that is true. That is true. Lucy, one of the things, and Aaron, there's this question of Nigel Farage and what he does with Aaron Banks, the donor, mm-hmm. all that. But actually, the problem with the Nigel Farage UKIP is it was all Nigel Farage
mm-hmm.
and media and causing outrage by appearance on the TV. The thing they were really bad at was the nuts and bolts building a party structure that made sure they didn't have nutters selected as candidates in for council elections, and you know, knowing which doors to knock on and which, you know, which to avoid and all that sort of stuff. And actually, for them to properly build a campaign in Stoke-on-Trent Central or a proper ground war, they need to get better at that stuff. Is there any sign that they are capable of doing that, or do they just end up thinking, actually, we've got Paul Nuttall on the telly again, so that's a win?
Well, actually, I think that UKIP have got better over the years at a by-election. And in fact, by-elections are quite easy compared to a general election because you can just flood a seat, as the Lib Dems did in Richmond, with all your activists, and you're not sort of spread too thinly. So I think that's not the problem. I think you're right that they have this lack of structures underpinning the party. But again, I think that that's something with time, and that's a sort of one of the tickets on which Paul Nuttall was elected leader, promising to professionalise the party. That's something that can be fixed. I think the much bigger problem is what Ian identified, and that's the identity crisis. And as you say, Farage had become this sort of demagogic figure, and he kept together these disparate factions through a sort of series of stick and sort of famous temper and sort of keeping people in check. But also, people looked up to him. He'd become this icon, this figurehead. And everyone in the party really agrees. He has taken them from sort of nothing fringe movement to being sort of centre stage or at least part of the mainstream now. But I wonder, I think one of the biggest missteps, or perhaps the thing I find most baffling, is why Paul Nuttall is following Nigel Farage's footsteps and yoking the party to Trump. It makes sense to me why Nigel Farage is doing that. You know, he thinks he might have a job, or he's got this in, the Donald, his new mate. But why... Why Paul Nuttall saying, well, yes, you know, I think, you know, maybe torture is a good idea, and sort of you know, I find that baffling.
I think pretty soon Paul Nuttall will be saying that torture is a good idea, but only for Nigel Farage. I think that's a very, you know, I think that's a really good analysis. And the great prize, of course, for the Conservatives, and this is what the Tory strategists know, is that all they need to change the electoral map, really, is to take back 4, 5, 6%, to sort of half the UKIP vote, to get them from around 12 to 7 or 8, and to convert those voters back into being Conservatives or Conservatives for the first time. And the Conservatives go from being 36%, as they were under David Cameron, to somewhere in the 40-41% zone. So I think that helps to explain why quite a lot of Prime Minister's words on Brexit means Brexit, etc. But I think that's why she's holding quite firm. There's a great electoral prize, and Labour in its current state is certainly not going to hoover up any UKIP votes. And
I don't think they know where the Hoover is.
But it's a terrific opportunity strategically for the Conservatives.
Well, I'm afraid we've got to leave it there. We're out of time. As ever, please do leave a review on iTunes, and we'll read out some of the best and the worst in the coming weeks. You can get in touch by emailing redbox@thetimes.co.uk, and you can tweet us @timesredbox or find us on Facebook. And again, sign up to my morning email briefing thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, from Lucy Fisher, Michael Cockwell, Ian Martin and me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story. The Times daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.